Many years ago, Swami Kriyananda did a lecture tour in Los Angeles, and one of the places where he spoke was the Bodhi Tree Bookstore. I'm not sure whether it's still there, but at the time, it was one of the huge bookstores and metaphysical centers in the whole Los Angeles area. And as part of their commitment to all spiritual traditions in their conference hall, where lecturers would speak, they had pictures of many great masters up on the walls, current and past. And the room was very, very full when Swami spoke. It wasn't that large. And so people were sitting on the floor against the wall in addition to all the regular seats. And one young man just came and, seeing the room was full, found a place against the wall in the back. And then Swamiji started talking about the concept of a guru and the need that we have to receive guidance from a source of wisdom that is greater than our own mind and our own preferences. But he was saying also that some people become confused and, hearing the need for a guru, sort of run around trying to shop for one, as if we were buying a new pair of shoes or a new hat. We just sort of go look at all the models, try them on, see which one flatters us the best, and then wear that one or is the most comfortable, which is not necessarily the way to look. But he was saying, if you look to your inner reality, if you make yourself receptive to divine truth, you don't have to go traveling around the world looking for a guru. Your guru will come to you. And right in the moment that he said that, this man who was sitting against the wall, the picture, which he had not noticed, which was above his head, which was Satya Sai Baba, who at that time was living in India and was well known as a spiritual teacher, it flipped, it came off the wall, it flipped over and landed upright on the man's lap. And so then all of a sudden he's just sitting there staring at Sai Baba. Now, to just make it even more interesting, the man had been contemplating for some time whether or not he should go to India to visit Sai Baba, because he felt powerfully drawn to him, but he just couldn't make up his mind as to what he should do. So he grabbed the picture and spent the rest of the time just holding it against his heart. Now, wonderful stories like that in modern times are very comforting, aren't they? I was remembering my version of it when I lived at Ananda Village in the 70s, 1970s. I lived alone in this little trailer. That was my, it was luxury quarters at that time, and my bed was across the width of the trailer, which my bed and the width of the trailer were the same, like this. And there was a shelf up above, and I had put photographs of all the masters. And one night, I was woken up from a dead sleep when Babaji just came off the thing and just landed. He didn't land face up, he landed face down, but smack on my heart. Just scared the bejesus out of me, as you can imagine. But then I looked at it and I thought, well, that got my attention. You know, and we begin to sort of think differently about these things. When I first came to the spiritual path, I guess confusion is actually the word that reigns. You know, we're a very interesting combination, all of us, of many simultaneous threads of reality at the same time. You know, children, young people, people at the beginning of their lives have a certain view of reality that just gradually takes time to sort out. And I was no different, raised in certain ways with commitment to my own ideas, and we just go through life, and it's so fantastic how uniquely individual we all are. And every one of us makes just so much sense to themselves. I'm looking at all your faces. Just take a moment and just look around. Just look around. I mean, they're all beautiful, but my. We can certainly recognize each other, can't we? Without much trouble at all, we can see how different we are. And each of these faces, the one we're carrying, was made exactly from the vibration of our consciousness to manifest exactly who we were supposed to be in this lifetime. The physical body, what you see here is just the physical body, but the vibration that's behind that is the karma stored in the chakras, which represents the sum total, it's really hard to believe this, of everything that's ever happened, like from all the way back to when we were evolving through the mineral stage, you know, through the animal stage, there's this individual spark of divinity. I'm just telling you about it. I've heard about it, so they say. This individual spark that's come all the way through, that has been through all these experiences, finally gets to the human level, then goes through all these lifetimes on the human level. Sometimes psychic will say, well, you've had 12 lifetimes or 37 lifetimes. Doesn't even begin to say it. I mean, with all due respect, think how long it takes us to learn even one lesson. Really. Swami Kriyananda once said that to me. Apropos of nothing, I'm sitting there washing the dishes in his house, and there was this little ledge here, and every so often he would just kind of put his elbows on the ledge and chat while I was washing the dishes. So he just leans over like this and he said, Master talks about liberation in one life, but really, he said, how likely is that? You know, he said, it takes people a whole incarnation just to learn to do Kriya, even just doing one Kriya right. And then he said, well, good night. Now, whether that was a universal or a personal message, I don't know. But I took it personally because it helped me. You know, oddly enough, instead of making me feel like, oh, what hope is there for me, I realized I have all the hope in the world. You know, I mean, if I just learn to do one Kriya rite, if I do one Kriya rite in this lifetime, yippee! You know, I've accomplished that. Any little thing that we manage to gain that we really know, you know, it's step by step by step by step. People reincarnate in the same families over and over again. They get born where they can get back into the same home, want the same language, the same food. It's just like these attachments just build, and very, very, very slowly it occurs to us that this desperate fulfillment that I'm looking for is not going to be found where I'm looking for it. And that's the beginning. That's the beginning of the whole journey. And all of us, with this unique reality that we've manifested, has just been created so that we can take the next step. I mean, everybody is standing on this field of movement, and we're not moving in a linear direction. What we're moving is we're all gradually moving toward the center. And that center is this infinite light which absorbs every one of us into its bliss. And in our own realities, like all our mental citizens are just standing in this periphery of interests, you know, interest in politics, interest in sports, interest in food, interest in friendship and having children and making this accomplishment and this. And all of these different things are all radiating from this center point of divinity. And we live either cut off from that divinity or we live from that divinity. And it's true, it's the same truth. It's just a question of whether we know it or not. And going back to my own beginning on the spiritual path when I was just 19 years old, and I was just so confused is actually the only word I can use. Many years later, when I basically coerce Swamiji into complimenting me one way or another, I just sort of managed to back him into a corner where he had to say something nice or hurt my feelings irrevocably. So he said, Asha, you're much less confused than you used to be. Which, of course, was not what I was hoping for. I wanted him to tell me that now it could be told that this was my last incarnation, that Babaji was coming to get me tomorrow. You know, I mean, I was really looking for something like that. And what I got was, you're a lot less confused than you used to be. But I was. And when I really just stepped back and thought about it, I thought, that's right. I used to be very confused. However, at the same time, I wasn't confused at all. And this is the part that's interesting. You know, we're living simultaneously on all these different levels. We have this sort of constant chatter and restless mind, and depending on our horoscope, it manifests in certain ways. Our horoscope is just an external picture of our inner physiology, so to speak, our metaphysics. But inside of all of that, and I'm sure all of you can say the same thing, I was born with a certain yearning. And it took me a little time to find out what it was that I was hungry for. And isn't that just what life is about? It takes us a long time to find out what we're hungry for. and we grab at this and we grab at that, we grab at this. I wanted, the first way I articulated that, I finally decided that I would have lots of children. I would have just this huge house full of children. That was my idea. But at a certain point, what I realized was that I felt so small. And I felt small in a way that wasn't charming to me. It was small, confined, limited, incapable. And so I wanted to multiply. So I thought I would just multiply physically. Of course, I didn't have a husband. I didn't have anything like that. But I would just multiply. But at a certain point, it occurred to me that even if I multiplied and had this house full of children to take care of, at the end of the day, when I crawled into bed and put my head on the pillow, I would still be there. And I would still be the same. And merely creating all that responsibility for myself would not change what I gradually came to understand was my essential consciousness and my essential experience of my own reality. My next step was to become very quietly, but absolutely hysterically desperate. Because who in this society talks to us about that? If you go to anybody and tell them that you're distressed, they'll send you to school, they'll, send you to a color consultant who will do your hair just right. You'll be encouraged to be aggressive in your career and all these different things, none of which are bad inherently, but nobody was talking to me about this essential terror of consciousness until Vivekananda, who was an Indian, great Indian teacher, and one of his books just came into my hand. Now, how does all of that happen? Like, where in this great universe? Oh, I can say I met the older brother of a high school friend of mine, and he had a friend who had a friend. Actually, oddly enough, the whole source of that was about a half a mile from here. This is like 1966. It all started a half a mile from here, where the center of the network had his home. And then he told this one, who told this one, who told this one, who then gave it to me. Now, who can track all of that? Like, how could I have calculated that? How could I have made a 5-year plan when I was 14? That when I'm 19, this and this and this and this will happen, and somebody will give me a book, and I will open that book, and it will talk to me about the only thing that matters to me. This limitation of consciousness and how to expand it. Because the odd thing about all of this is, despite the fact that now more people are talking about this. 1966 was quite a long time ago. This has become much more the common parlance. But still, compared to the number of people on the planet, the number of people in this room is small. The number of people who are really concerned about the question of consciousness, there aren't very many of this. So it's not as if it's a mass movement, but it's a mass movement for every individual. That's how I want to think about it. A number of years ago, somebody did some research, and then they published it, and it got a huge 15 minutes of fame. It said, an unmarried woman over the age of 40 is more likely to get killed by a terrorist than she is to ever marry again. Somebody did research and announced that, which sent kind of a bad wave through a lot of people's ideas. It was just one of those stupid things that people do. But in any case, Swami's remark was extremely interesting. He said, there's no such thing as statistics. There's no such thing as probability. He said, you can do all the studies you want. There's only individual karma. Your karma can be 100% to be killed by a terrorist, or 0% to ever marry again. It's just who we are. We move through this world apparently influenced by this external reality, but the fact of the matter is all we're moving from is this field of karma that is within us and the consciousness that we have developed over all these millions of lifetimes that have brought us right to this point. In the life of Jesus, which is so magnificent, and he's heading off to be crucified, and of course we already know the end of the movie. It's like we can't really walk down the street and not know what's going to happen. We know it's going to end badly in the short term and really well in the long term for Jesus. But he's walking toward that horrible seeming destiny of arrest and torture and humiliation and crucifixion. And someone says to him, essentially, why don't you do something about this? And he says, for this hour was I born. Oh, you know, the drums come up and the violins play and it's the colors get really big. I mean, it's just magnificent. The whole earth vibrates. But the weird thing about that statement, if you think about it, every single one of us can say that at every point in our incarnation. And interestingly, as hard as it is for the mind to get around it from the human level, our destiny in this moment is as cosmically important as that of Jesus. Every soul is equal before God. In our Festival of Light recently, relatively recently, Swamiji added to that, we are all equal before God, not only Jesus Christ and Babaji and Krishna and all those great masters that we see whose names are writ large on the screen of history and whose destiny has changed the course of the planet. We just can't help but think that God likes them better. Because that's how we evaluate each other and ourselves, isn't it? We're always thinking about what it looks like. But God has only one need from us. The way Master puts it in a rather charming way, God has everything but our love. All he lacks is our love. And once he has our love, which is to say, our awakened understanding of the purpose of life, then the very angels celebrate. You know, these pictures of that's when the everything shifts and the angels come and drop rose petals on your head and all of that. Because once we begin to awaken, then we're on our way home, just like this. And those who have achieved that, Christ, Buddha, Krishna, all those, are the ones most of all cheering us on. There's something incredibly important to realize about these great souls, which is sort of hard to keep in your mind. Christianity has completely lost this because they got competitive somewhere along the way, and Jesus had to be the only one, and they had no tradition of great masters appearing periodically, so gradually Jesus becomes unique, which is really the tragedy of Christianity, because then we're all just helplessly waiting for grace. There's just sort of no place. You know, there was ever only one, and here we are. It's very confusing. You just kind of shift that just a little bit. Now, everything in Christianity makes a lot more sense. But the point is, let me just a second find the point. I see the lights keep blinking, which keeps sort of like, ta-da, something's going to happen here. Okay. If somebody could release a shower of rose petals on us all now, it would be really just perfect, wouldn't it? The lights are blinking. Ooh, look at that. But, oh, I know what I was going to say. You know, to really understand that we are all equal before God, that we're all equally created by the same, I know what I was going to say. Every soul who has attained self-realization at some point wasn't self-realized. And every single transition of through levels of consciousness that every one of the people that we all just looked at noticed how different we all are, every single level of consciousness that the individual jiva, the individual spirit, has to go through from the beginning to the end, from manifestation to self-realization, Jesus has walked that way, Yogananda has walked that way, Buddha has walked that way, Krishna has walked that way. We don't hear those incarnations as much. There's wonderful in the poem, The Light of Asia, which is about the enlightenment of Buddha, absolutely a beautiful poem. He talks about some of his former lifetimes. Yogananda talks about some of his, but they're all after realization. But right where we're standing, Jesus himself, he wasn't called Jesus then, he was called something else, but that spark of divinity was standing right there. And so whatever it is that we feel, there's nothing to be ashamed about it or concerned about it, or to think somehow that we're not living up to our own potential. We just are what we are. As Swami said, how much progress can you make in one lifetime anyway? Just learn to do one kriya correctly. Good night. You know, that's really all there is to it. And what we're working with is just that gradual process within ourselves where we begin to weigh one thing against another and realize that spirit keeps coming out on top. No matter how we try to cut it up, no matter how far we experiment, no matter how hard we try. You know, when I first moved to this Palo Alto area, back to it, in my life I've lived here two or three different times, but this has been the longest and most continuous. Three different times. This was the third time back here. This somehow, they say that there's astrological geography, and there must be here. But when I first moved here from Ananda Village, which was the rural community where I lived for my first 16 years of spiritual life, and came here, and I was trying to tell my country ashram friends, because everything here, I mean, it's getting a little crazier now. We've been here about 30 years, so we've watched it through. But I will preface that by saying my friend Keshava, who's Canadian-American, has lived in India for the last almost 14 years. And I said to Keshava, how do you do it? You know, how are you comfortable here? He said, I never make comparisons. Isn't that simple? I just never make comparisons. It just is what it is. Why would I think about it being any other way? Because this is what it is. When you've lived in a place for 30 years, you can't help but think there didn't used to be this much traffic on the road. And then you say, nope. Nope. But when I first came here, I tried to describe it to my friends because it is and was. It's just an absolutely wonderful place to live. The weather is perfect. The people are marvelous. It's educated. It's sophisticated. Within 10 minutes of where you live, you can just about fulfill any desire that you have. Any desire. My friends would come and visit, and I would say, what do you want? I'll go get it for you. You know, new clothes, new friends, entertainment. What would you like? Food of any kind? Newspapers from Paris? I'll go get them for you, and I'll be back before breakfast, you know, like that. And I finally decided that this area is the effort by intelligent, cultivated, refined, broad-minded people are making one last desperate attempt to see if we can find satisfaction on the material plane. And we're just all working so hard together. This time it's going to work. But you know, it's very, very, very good karma to be born wealthy, to be born in a privileged position. Because what it gets you to do is you get to find out. You know, because in our self-realization temples, we have a very ethnically diverse group, but we rarely get people who are struggling to come up financially or socially, because in their minds, happiness will still come from that. And I don't mean that in any, because that also cuts across ethnic and cultural and racial lines. But if the attitude is, I will be happy if I can get this, and it's karmically right. If that's what you're thinking and feeling, that's what you have to keep doing. Nobody listens to anybody. Have you noticed that? You may be married, you may have children, you might have noticed that. Even you have friends, you know, nobody listens to anybody else. They're polite. And they'll even say, that's a very good idea. And if you exert enough willpower, you can actually dominate them with your ideas, which is not a good idea, but it's still something that we do. But nobody ever listens. We listen when we experience. And then after you experience, and then you know. I remember one of my girlfriends made an unfortunate mistake. And afterwards she said to me, why didn't you tell me? I said, I did. She had absolutely no memory, absolutely no memory. I have a very clear memory. I knew exactly where it was and what I said. Nothing, absolutely gone. Because not ready to hear that, so it just never happens. But when you experience it, then you know. Master said something so interesting. He said, anything that you no longer wish to do or are drawn to do, such as murder, pillaging, you know, torturing other people, I mean, things that, praise God, I hope none of us are inclined to do. I mean, really not inclined to do. Master gave us the chilling statement that the reason we're not inclined to do it is because we've done it. And we found out that it didn't work. Just as simple as that. And so whether or not, I'm going to finally try to bring this back to our topic today, whether or not we actually need a guru or have a guru, really, we have a guru all the way along. We are always being guided by our guardian angels. We are always being guided by beings higher than us. And the beings who are guiding us are the ones that we'll listen to. If the only beings we're listening to are the ones who can help us to have great worldly experience and great worldly success and be really gorgeous and successful in the ways of the world, that's what our guides will tell us, because we're not going to listen to anything else. And it's not really a backwards gesture. We're going forward to find out what's true, which is exactly what a highly evolved saint is doing. He's going forward, she's going forward to find out what's true. And we're always being guided. And that picture will fall off the shelf and drop on your lap. You know, that book will be given into your hands, that flyer, that door. People sometimes will come into this church and they'll say, I've been driving by this church for 15 years. And then all of a sudden, the moment will come and they'll just come in the door. And sometimes then they'll never leave. But it took 15 years of just seeing it coming by before all the karmic forces aligned to do it. And we think that we're just making that decision all by ourselves. When I was 19 years old, and the older brother of my high school friend handed me this book about Vivekananda, was that like a random event? Was nobody paying any attention? Can you imagine how many lifetimes and how many angels had to all work together to put us all together right in that very spot for that to happen? Don't kid yourself. We are not independent. We are not making our own decisions. And the power of having a guru is not the guru. He's all finished. He's free. It means nothing to him. They're not keeping tally. Jesus says to Babaji, I've got 700 million disciples. How many do you have? You know, one more for me. Nothing like that. They're just beacons of light, just sending it out. And our job, so simple, is to become disciples. And you can be a disciple long before you know who your guru is. And you can only have a guru when you become a disciple. And what being a disciple means is, I really want to learn. And all of this, I want to do it myself my way, is overtaken by the fact, a very simple fact, I'm hungry, I'm lonely, I'm frightened, I'm small, I'm sad. And then you pray what I call the piglet prayer from Winnie the Pooh. Piglet and Pooh are lost in the fog. They're actually not very far from home, but it's very, very foggy. And Pooh has a little more courage than Piglet. Piglet tends to fold up when times get hard. So Piglet folds up in the fog, and there's this little tiny little illustration. You all have seen the Pooh. And little Piglet, he has his head down like this, and he's lost in the fog. He just doesn't know. And then finally, somehow, with the last bit of courage that Piglet has, he raises his head and he says, help, 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 like that. Then he goes back down again. To my experience, the Piglet prayer is the most powerful prayer. It's really the one that God listens to. And even if you pray it in a very, if you're not too busy, Lord, perhaps you could send a little light in my direction. Or if you're collapsed on the floor and can just raise your head a quarter of an inch. Become a disciple. Ask for help. And it's like a sea of angels are just waiting for the tiniest opening to take us home. God bless.